Hello and welcome to Lives and Times of the Judges, a series of interviews with former judges of the Federal Court of Australia. Today I'm talking to the Honourable Robert French, AC, who was appointed to the Federal Court in 1986, aged 39. During that time, he was also chair and first president of the National Native Title Tribunal. In 2008, he became Chief Justice of the High Court of Australia, retiring in 2017. We started the interview off in his office, in front of a commissioned portrait of him by the artist Lewis Miller. So, what does he think of it?
I quite like it, but that opinion is not universally shared. One of my associates, when he saw the portrait, said, "Makes you look 15 years older and sick." And I said to him, "Well, I'll grow into that." The Dorian Gray in reverse.
Have you always collected art?
No, I'm not a big collector of art, but I do like to have a couple of nice paintings on the wall. This one is a photograph of a forest at Walpole, down on the south coast. It's about 50 k's to the west of Denmark. You can see the white branches and trunks against the dark. It's quite striking, and looking across a river there, I think.
How important is being Australian and being a West Australian to you?
I'm very lucky to have been born and to have lived in Australia. I think despite all its issues and problems, it is really one of the world's most successful representative democracies in terms of its longevity. Despite the clunky old constitution we have, it still seems to work.
Did you find that being a judge from Western Australia, there was an East Coast bias?
Well, certainly the numbers in the court were from outside Western Australia, and that's perfectly understandable. Initially, when I was appointed, there were two of us on the Federal Court in Perth. John Toohey went off to the High Court, and it was another 18 months before a replacement was appointed. So for quite some time, I was the only resident judge in Perth. Of course, we had visiting judges who would come from the East to help out. But even by the time I had left, I think we had four resident judges in Perth, and the groupings in Melbourne and Sydney in particular were much larger, as you would expect. And for some reason, the people in Queensland managed to persuade the Chief Justice of the day that they needed five judges, even though we reckoned their workload wasn't really that much greater than ours. But there were two aspects to this. Firstly, it was really good to be part of a small registry where there were four of us who did everything, and we didn't sort of divvy up into specializations or anything of that kind. And at the same time as having four who were really running our own show with a fairly light touch from the centre, we were participating in the national work of the court, sitting on appeal courts right around the country. So I never felt that we were marginalised as federal court judges. The court came into existence in 1976, and I joined in November 1986.
Did you have a sense that you were joining a new court that you would help to shape?
I don't know about helping to shape it. I was 39 at the time I was appointed. I hadn't taken silk. I was at the bar. The West Australian profession is a fused profession, an amalgam, so that I had practiced since my admission in 1972 as both a barrister and solicitor, but largely as an advocate appearing in courts and doing my own counsel work. And I had started to get into federal court practice while I was still a partner in my own law firm and then at the bar. And also, during that time I was at the bar, I was an associate member of the Trade Practices Commission, which is the national competition regulator, the precursor to the ACCC. And when the offer came to accept appointment to the federal court, despite all the urgings of people who said it was all too early and I was missing out on a wonderful life as a senior barrister, it seemed to me that this was the most interesting thing I was likely to be able to do. And that was because it was a national court with an interesting and increasing, expanding jurisdiction, and with judges from the best, from the various Australian bars, and that I would be able to sit not only in Perth but on appeals and do trial work around the country. So that made it very attractive to me.
So yes, 39 was very young even back then, wasn't it? Because although there were several judges that were appointed in their 40s, most people go on the bench when they're in their 50s, don't they?
Yeah, I think it varies a bit, but certainly that was a young age for appointment. The Queenslanders tend to appoint judges to their Supreme Courts, or had a track record of appointing very young judges to their Supreme Courts. And initially, I had been appointed to replace James Muirhead. James Muirhead had been a judge of the Supreme Court of the Northern Territory. He joined the federal court for a time, but didn't much like the work. And I think he then went back to the Northern Territory and later became the administrator of the Northern Territory. John Toohey was the other resident judge in Perth. He'd been appointed to the federal court back in, I think it was 1976, or 1977 actually, when he was also appointed as the first Aboriginal Land Rights Commissioner under the Aboriginal Land Rights Northern Territory Act, which was Commonwealth law. But when he finished the work in the Northern Territory, he came back to Perth, which is his home state. So he and I were on the bench together, but only for a very short time, a matter of a couple of months, because he was appointed to the High Court in February 1987.
Robert French's appointment to the bench was under the Federal Court's first Chief Justice, Sir Nigel Bowen. So what was he like?
Nigel Bowen was fundamental to the establishment of the court as a court of judicial excellence, and that was through the people whom he undoubtedly recruited to the court, and I might call it the judicial culture that he established within the court, and the collegiality that he fostered within the court, notwithstanding that its members were spread around the whole of this continent. And that, I think, was a signal achievement. The impression I had was that the judges were all of a very high quality. And I'd appeared before the full court on which Nigel Bowen was presiding on a particularly interesting case involving a member of the Commonwealth Crown Solicitor's Office here in Perth who had come under an adverse mention in the Costigan Royal Commission. But without going into all of that, I was impressed by Bowen's demeanour on the bench. He was what I saw as the model of a good judge, calm, courteous, and highly intelligent and incisive. He had political skills, by which I mean small p political skills, and of course he had spent some time, as everybody knows, as a minister. And although all the members of the court were drawn from the higher ranks of the practicing legal profession, there was a degree of diversity in approaches and philosophies among the judges, and he managed those quite well. Although I do remember on one occasion, the Queenslanders were always a little bit challenging of what the other states and their judges were doing. And on one occasion, I was at the judges' meeting when Nigel Bowen was presiding. And after some discussion on the topic, he said, "Well, I think the feeling of the meeting is," at which point I think it might have been Bill Pinkus from Queensland, he said, "Well, what do you mean by the feeling of the meeting? Is that what you think? And do we get to vote on this?" And so I think it all went to a vote after that. He got his way.
And what about Michael Black's legacy?
Michael Black, his successor, he also maintained and developed that collegiality, which was fundamental to the working of the court, and of course oversaw an increase in the size of the court, which of course brought its own challenges of management and participation and so forth. He was also very important in the development of the court's physical infrastructure in terms of the court buildings in Perth and in Adelaide and in Melbourne. And he became quite closely involved in design issues. I think the Perth one might have started before his time. But yes, I would tell Michael that he had a pharaonic tendency. He was erecting monuments around the country. He was also a delight to work with.
It's interesting looking at your early career because I believe you studied physics at university and you actually, I gather, decided to do a law degree because it gave you more options in employment than physics. Tell me about that. Tell me about these youthful choices.
Yeah, well, I did physics initially believing that I was going to be a physicist, and I got involved in all sorts of other things at university. And by the end of my physics degree, I was persuaded that I was not going to be a great theoretical physicist. And I've often told the story that the professor of physics, after my presentation of a seminar to fellow students in third year, said to me, "You express yourself magnificently, but I'm not sure you know what you're talking about." So I say that thus encouraged and qualified, I enrolled in law. But the reason I went to law was I decided that it would offer the widest range of career options. One of them, of course, would be practicing law. Another would be going into public service, perhaps diplomatic service. Another would be going into the private sector. And when I completed the law degree, the one thing I enjoyed was jurisprudence. That was the closest the law could get to theoretical physics. And when I completed the law degree, I thought, well, I had better at least do the articles, which is a two-year apprenticeship that you do prior to admission, so I can get admitted, and then I'll decide what I want to do. I had flirted with the idea of joining the External Affairs Department and was going to be interviewed, and then I decided, no, I'll go and do the articles and see how I go. And I joined a small firm, the senior partner of which was a friend of the family. It was so easy in those days to get articles, you just rang someone up. And that was a great experience because it was a very generalist practice, and I found that I was engaging with real people and real problems which had legal responses to them. I got involved in some court cases, and I was also at that time involved with the Aboriginal Legal Service, which I'd helped to establish along with some other young practitioners. George Winterton was one who later became Professor of Constitutional Law at UNSW and then Sydney, and Philip Clark, who later became the inaugural Dean of Law at Deakin University. Graham MacDonald, who was later for a short time one of my law partners. And through that connection also, I became involved in doing some criminal law work for Indigenous people. And otherwise, I was doing quite a lot of work in the magistrates' courts, getting experience in defending people on various charges. And that's where I became exposed to the importance of statutory interpretation, because a lot of the work I was doing involved statutory offences, and that involved interpreting statutes. And many years later, when I was on the High Court, I found our core work, which didn't surprise me at all, was statute work.
Let's go a little way back, because between your physics degree and your admission to practice, you flirted with politics and you stood as a Liberal candidate for Fremantle, I gather, against Kim Beazley Sr. So tell us about this early interest in politics. Where did it come from? Do you come from a political family?
No, not at all. Although my mother was a very good small P politician, and she did get involved with the Liberal Party later on in her life. Now, I joined the university Liberal Club in the 1960s, and I was president of that club in 1968, I think it was. They weren't a branch of the Young Liberal movement. They had a separate identity, and there was a national network of those university clubs called the Australian Universities Liberal Federation. And they were on what today would be called the moderate liberal spectrum, or small L liberals. So they weren't on the, if you like, the conservative side of the party. But in 1969, we had a federal election, and I decided to put my hat in the ring for pre-selection for the federal seat of Fremantle. It was a pretty easy run to pre-selection because nobody else was interested in taking it on. It had been a Labor seat since the 1940s. And Kim Beazley Sr. was a highly respected federal politician and minister, and very well liked within his electorate. There are about 59,000 people in the electorate. So there was quite a range of and diversity of electors and people that I met. And I had a very proactive campaign manager. His name was Chilla Porter. He was the father of Christian Porter, who later became the Commonwealth Attorney General. But Chilla had been a medal-winning Olympic high jumper or long jumper. I think it was high jumpers, actually. And he was the executive in charge of the Fremantle Division of the Liberal Party. So we raised the princely sum of $2,000 in campaign funding. And there was a group whom I knew who had a rock band called The Timepiece. And we went to Rottnest on one occasion because Rottnest Island is part of the electorate. And we stood on a truck outside the pub there with the band playing and me making speeches. And whenever the band stopped playing and I started to make a speech, people would move forward and start shaking the truck. So, of course, I went down. He was 62% and I was about 30%. But I consoled myself by saying it was the smallest swing against the Liberal Party in any part of Australia.
So how did that sit with the politics of the late 60s and early 70s? This was the time of Vietnam, of huge social changes. Were those social changes as strong here in WA? And how were they manifesting themselves around you?
It was very much a generational change in attitudes to government, to political issues. And I think that was driven significantly by the Vietnam War and conscription, because that was something that potentially directly affected my contemporaries of the day. And that was reflected in a concern, obviously, about the legitimacy of the Vietnam War, the legitimacy of conscription, but spilled over into wider issues like the state of education and all sorts of other things that we discussed. We used to have large general meetings of students to discuss these questions.
In the early 70s, Robert French was one of the co-founders of the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia. So what got him involved?
It really started, I suppose, with the 1969 campaign. Among the people that I met during that campaign were women who were members of the Melville Attardale Women's Branch. They had a separate women's branch of the Liberal Party. And the president of that branch was a woman called Aoli Burkett, who had been one of a number of Australian nurses who'd been imprisoned by the Japanese during the Second World War. And she and a bunch of friends had been to a University of Western Australia summer school called A New Era for Aboriginal People. And as a result of their exposure to the issues of facing Indigenous people, they set up an organisation called the New Era Aboriginal Fellowship. And I became involved with it and set up a subcommittee called the Justice Committee. And there are a number of people involved with that Justice Committee, including Fred Cheney. I think Peter Dowling might have been involved, who later became State Premier, George Winterton, Graham MacDonald, and a number of others, and some leading Indigenous people of the day, Jack Davis and others. And initially we were sort of making representations to state government ministers to have appropriate training for police and justices of the peace who had a lot to do with Aboriginal people. And we got back these sort of standard form answers from the ministers that everybody's equal before the law and so nobody needed special training to deal with Aboriginal people, which was absolute nonsense, of course. And then we started looking into the provision of some sort of advisory service. And towards the end of 1972, we were trying to establish a duty counsel service at the East Perth Court, which is where most first appearances were made after arrests. And we were looking for some fairly modest sum to help support that. And then the Whitlam government came to power and Gordon Bryant, who was the then minister, I think ended up offering us sufficient funds to provide representation for Aboriginal people throughout Western Australia. And that committee became the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia. And another committee of the same organisation, the Medical Committee, became the Aboriginal Medical Service of Western Australia. So it was a very interesting history. And, you know, it was a wonderful example of collaboration across political and ideological diversity.
When you joined the Federal Court, the Native Title Act was still far in the future. Did you anticipate that the Federal Court would have such an involvement in Native Title when you joined?
No, I didn't. It did have an involvement under the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity legislation and racial discrimination legislation. In fact, there are a number of acts in which the Federal Court had ultimate jurisdiction, the Racial Discrimination Act, the Sex Discrimination Act, they were the principal ones at the time, I think. But I certainly didn't foresee the wide-ranging jurisdiction with respect to native title. I had had an exposure before going to the federal court. I was junior counsel for the Commonwealth in Kuwata in the Commonwealth, which was a case in which the state of Queensland was challenging the validity of the Racial Discrimination Act. And I was junior counsel to Maurice Byers, who was then the Solicitor General for the Commonwealth. That was about 1981, 82. And that case, as it turned out, was a key case in underpinning what was later to be recognised as the common law of native title, because by establishing the validity of the Race Discrimination Act, it maintained the validity of provisions of that act, which would prevent, for example, the states from extinguishing native title without compensation, because that would be a discriminatory basis of dealing with property rights, which would contravene the Race Discrimination Act.
Robert French was appointed as the chair and first president of the National Native Title Tribunal in 1994. This independent body was established under the Native Title Act 1993 as a special measure for the advancement and protection of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. However, Robert French says that he saw his role as an impartial one.
To be clear, with respect to the National Native Title Tribunal, my philosophy from the time I was appointed was not that I was there as an advocate for First Peoples. I was there to administer a public authority which was set up to receive claims for recognition of native title, to register them, to try to mediate between the Indigenous people making the claim and the whole array of non-Indigenous interests affected by them, which would include state and territory governments, the Commonwealth government itself, and an array of vested interests in industry and agriculture and so forth, and in particular the mining and pastoral industries. And it was critical to the credibility of the National Native Title Tribunal that it was not seen as simply on the side of the Indigenous people. It was there to carry out a statutory mandate. And whilst, of course, a lot of the messaging that we had to carry out in the early years of the Act was to try and hose down anxieties and say, look, this is not going to result in you losing your backyard. These rights and interests can coexist with yours where they are established. They don't take away your freehold title. They can't in that case, because that's extinguishment. They're not going to take away any other titles that you might have. So there was a lot of educational activity happening, but on the basis that we were there to assist all parties in the process whilst furthering the process. And in fact, internally within the Native Title Tribunal, where we had, you know, young people who were very gung-ho and supportive of Indigenous rights, understandably, I said, we'll have a rule called the eyebrow rule. You will hear outrageous and offensive things said from time to time in the course of your interaction with a whole range of interests, and you should not even raise your eyebrow at those. You just play a straight bat.
In 1994, Robert French, as president of the tribunal, refused registration of a claim by the Wanyi people over land that was the subject of the proposed Century Zinc Mine in North Queensland. The decision, which became known as the French Testing Case, was a controversial one and was overturned by the High Court.
With respect to testing, there were a lot of claims being made, and one of our functions was to register them if there was a prima facie case. And I took the view with respect to the Wanyi claim in the Gulf of Carpentaria area that that claim could not succeed because it was made over historic pastoral leases, and that those historic pastoral leases didn't have provisions in them for Aboriginal access, and that relying upon what Justice Brennan had said in the Mabo judgment, that that would result in the extinguishment of native title. So I made that decision in, you know, trying to apply a reasonably rigorous registration test. Anyway, that was upheld in the full court of the federal court where it was challenged, and then went to the High Court, which with considerable moral enthusiasm allowed the appeal without reasons and gave reasons later. And there were people from the Wanyu group led by Murrindu Yana sitting in court with T-shirts bearing the slogan, "Ban French Testing," which I thought was wonderful. And I spoke to Murrindu Yana sometime later and asked him if I could get one of the T-shirts, and he said he wouldn't give me one because I'd cost him too much in legal fees. But many years later, and in fact only a few years ago, I was speaking at the IATSIS conference in North Queensland. Yana was there and all seemed to be forgiven. Now, I wasn't emotionally devastated by that. If you're a judge, you are used to being reversed on appeal, and if you don't get reversed on appeal from time to time, it may be because you're being too careful to insulate yourself against appeal. And my public response to the decision was, well, the court has emphasised the role of the tribunal in mediation rather than in that kind of quasi-judicial function, and we respect that and we'll respond to it.
So you have to have a tough skin, and you have to also accept that there's more than one decision that you can come to, because dissent is part of the law. And thinking of a big case like the Tampa affair, which was one where you and Justice Beaumont agreed and Justice Black dissented. Do you always feel that you got things right?
The decision was essentially whether or not the people on board the Tampa at the time that it was interdicted were being unlawfully detained. And the judge at first instance had issued a writ of habeas corpus, determining that they had been unlawfully detained and that they should be brought onto the mainland. And the essential logic of the decision, although, you know, people argue to the contrary, is that firstly, the executive had power deriving from the Constitution to prevent the entry into Australia of people who were not entitled to enter into Australia. And that to prevent the entry of someone into Australia who did not have the legal authority to enter Australia was not an interference with their rights. And that habeas corpus was misconceived. Now, the point of difference between Michael Black and myself, he was in dissent, was whether the executive had non-statutory power, in other words, power deriving directly from the Constitution, to do that. And that's what became the subject of contention later on. But as I said in a recent lecture, I think this was the inaugural Michael Crommelin lecture at Melbourne University, that the decision in Tampa is lovingly excoriated by all right-thinking people. And certainly the criticism of it didn't bother me in the least. It's part of the business of being a judge that you will make decisions from time to time that have political consequences or that people disapprove of from the perspective of their values. And if you can't wear the fact that you're going to be criticised, whether from a values basis or from a legal basis or some other basis, then you really shouldn't be in the job, particularly not in the job of public law adjudication. In fact, some of the thoughts that I had in Tampa about executive power informed my own approach to executive power in some later important cases in the High Court, the Pape case and the Williams cases, which concerned the power of the Commonwealth to expend money. Incidentally, Tampa was a case which demonstrated the collegial character of work on the federal court, even where people were in disagreement. We heard the case in Melbourne, and I think we heard it on a Thursday and gave judgment on the following Tuesday. We were meeting together from time to time and exchanging views. And I remember we went out and had lunch together at some cafe called the Afghan in the Victorian markets. And there was certainly no tension between us arising from that disagreement. In fact, Michael typically characterized our disagreement as scholarly. There are other people who are prepared to be more trenchant in their criticisms, but it was a delight working with him. And that was very much, I think, a feature collaboration.
I have asked everyone I've interviewed what makes a good judge, and I would imagine from what you've just been saying that a thick skin must be one of them. But what are the other qualities that you see as important?
Well, I think they're pretty well commonly understood. You've got to have a good working knowledge of the law in the jurisdiction in which you are adjudicating. You've got to have the judicial temperament. That is to say, you are calm and courteous in your approach to parties who appear before you. You're attentive to the evidence. You do your best to make an honest decision based upon the facts that you find and the law that you apply to those facts. Diligence, timeliness, these are all important characteristics, and a greater focus on some of those aspects now than perhaps there used to be. And of course, now we see a much greater emphasis also on awareness of diversity within our community and how that diversity impacts on the way that people may present in court and how you judge what they're saying. So it started years back with gender awareness programs, and then we got into cultural awareness programs, which I was involved in organising through the Australian Institute of Judicial Administration, later the National Judicial College, with respect to First Peoples, and then more broadly, multicultural awareness. When I was Chief Justice, I supported the establishment of the Council on Judicial Diversity, which was an initiative really which originated with the Australian Migration Council, but was adopted and supported by the Council of Chief Justices, and Wayne Martin, the former Chief Justice of Western Australia, was its first chair, and they were doing things like producing bench books for judges and so forth. Now, there's much more early judicial education. Newly appointed judges will often be sent off to what's jokingly called baby judges school, and more experienced judges will talk to them about the arts of writing judgments and time management and demeanour in court and all those sorts of things, and your relationships with your colleagues and so forth.
The stress and the load of work must take its toll. Does decision-making come naturally? And do you relish coming to a conclusion based on the law, or do you agonise?
Well, I think decision-making as a judge is hard work. There's no doubt about that, especially in the civil jurisdiction where you are deciding both questions of fact and law. In the federal court, it was almost all written judgments, and you had to write the judgments. And sometimes you have a pile of judgments, and you know that's the greatest stress, actually, is having judgments where you've got to catch up. What I would tend to do is to write a judgment, immersing and re-immersing myself in the facts until a reasonably clear picture emerged of the way I should find those facts. It was rarely a case of going straight in and saying, oh, yes, the answer, this is crystal clear. And the cases about which I felt most awkward in delivering judgments were cases involving people of medium means who'd got involved in civil litigation. And I would go into court sometimes feeling that I was going to ruin somebody's day, possibly their month, possibly the rest of the year or beyond, because whoever lost in those cases would bear the cost burden ordinarily of the other side as well as their own costs. And for people of medium income, that could be a life-altering outcome. There were sometimes reputational consequences of a decision, and one didn't always go into court feeling totally confident that you were making the right decision. You know, you had to make a decision. That was the job, and the fact of doing the job wasn't of itself stressful. It was engaging and interesting. And the great thing about the federal court, and the reason I really joined it, was because of the diversity of the jurisdiction and the fact, the very important fact, that it involved both original jurisdiction, that is sitting as a trial judge, and appellate jurisdiction, that is sitting as one of a group of appeal judges. So I always thought that appeal judges should maintain a strong sense of the pressures on trial judges and the nature of the decision that trial judges make. I have always thought it's a mistake to appoint someone directly to an appeal court who hasn't had considerable trial experience, both in the criminal and in the civil jurisdictions.
I heard an interview with you in 2016, and you were talking about winding up as the Chief Justice of the High Court, and you said that you weren't going to be one of those judges that made any major political comments once you'd left office, that you were just going to concentrate on a bit of writing and be quite quiet. But yet recently you've spoken up very strongly about the referendum and the voice to Parliament. And this is obviously something that is very important to you.
Well, I've got a concern about overspeaking retired judges. It was like retired generals coming out and saying how the war should be run, you know. But certainly I did see the voice proposal as a matter of some significance and potential benefit, given my particular interest in that whole area. I was happy to support it. Of course, it became a lot more divisive than one might have expected, and we know the result.
You've also spoken about republicanism and about the way that the Constitution is currently figured. You've been quoted as saying that it's unacceptable in contemporary Australia that the legal head of the Australian state can never be chosen by the people or their representatives. Can it be other than a member of the Anglican Church, and can never be other than British? Do you identify strongly as a Republican?
I'd actually made a speech while I was a serving federal judge. It was the Ronald Wilson lecture. I think it was entitled Dreams of a New Republic. I mean, I didn't say anything about it while I was a serving Chief Justice. And since then, I have spoken again about it. And while I'm not an active Republican campaigner, I've taken the position which you've just quoted, that there is something faintly absurd about the current arrangements. Unfortunately, the experience with the voice referendum has probably made people a bit gun-shy about referenda. My view has always been that the notion of an appointed president is hard to sell. An elected president who the Australian people can own, in the way they don't own the Governor-General, and even less the monarch, is, I think, something whose day will come eventually, but it'll take a while.
You obviously have demonstrated throughout your career that you've maintained an interest in other fields of life. So how important is keeping a life outside the law?
The law doesn't have to be a bubble. If you lose yourself in the bubble of the law and lose connection with the community in which you live and with what people who are non-lawyers are doing, then you become less of a lawyer and less of a judge, because ultimately the law must engage with and is it's part of the framework of the community within which a whole bunch of non-law things are done.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for giving me so much time.
That's fine. Thank you. Enjoyed it.